and can't you wonder at this show? But wonder on, till truth make all things plain. This man is Pyramus, if you would know. This beauteous lady, Thisbe, is certain. This man with lime and rum cast doth present wall, that vile wall which did these lovers sunder. This man with lantern, dog and bush of thorn presenteth moonshine. This grisly beast is lion height by name. For all the rest, let lion, moonshine, wall, and a lover's twain at large discourse. While here they do remain.
Gentles, perchance you wonder at this show, but wonder on till truth make all things plain. You may recognize the words. They're from the play Pyramus and Thisbe, which is performed inside Shakespeare's comedy A Midsummer Night's Dream, which in this case is further wrapped up inside a Benjamin Britten opera. Got all that? Well, wonder on. If you love Shakespeare, you'll know that when the bard promises to make things plain, you'd better hold on with both hands. My name is Nicholas Ivor Martin. I'm the director of operations at Lyric Opera, and today I'd like to speak to you about Benjamin Britten's opera, A Midsummer Night's Dream. The remarkable thing about Shakespeare's play is that you don't need to understand it to enjoy it. It's a comedy. Lots of people are confused and running around in the forest. Some kind of odd custody dispute is going on in the fairy world. Somebody's father is mad about something. There's a fight. Everyone falls asleep. Magic spells are cast. Everyone wakes up. They fight some more. They kiss and make up. Big comic finish. Quite fun. If you attend Britten's opera with the same open mind you would take to the play, you'll have just as much fun. So why not leave it at that? The only answer I can come up with is that without a deeper understanding of the opera, and specifically of the music, you'll miss some of the jokes. When Shakespeare's comic characters rehearse their Pyramus and Thisbe, they read all the stage directions aloud, along with their lines. If you're not intimately familiar with the mechanics of the theater, you won't fully appreciate the mechanicals. Listen again to the prologue spoken by Nick Bottom the Weaver. I played it partly because it's a fun tune. You could listen to it and smile, and that would be that. But let's probe a little bit deeper. The plot of the play within a play is a poor man's Romeo and Juliet. You have two neighbors, Pyramus and Thisbe, who are in love, but whose parents don't want them to get married. They whisper to each other through a wall. When they agree to meet by moonlight, a lion comes along and chases Thisbe away. Pyramus, thinking the lion has eaten Thisbe, kills himself. And when Thisbe returns to discover her love dead, she too stabs herself. In the prologue, Bottom is introducing all these characters: Pyramus, Thisbe, the wall, Moonshine, and the lion.
Enters, perchance you wonder at this show. But wonder on, till truth make all things plain. This man is Pyramus, if you would know. This beauteous lady, Thisbe, is certain. This man with lime and rum cast doth present wall, that vile wall which did these lovers sunder. This man with lantern, dog and bush of thorn presenteth moonshine. This grisly beast is lion height by name. For all the rest, let lion, moonshine, wall, and a lover's twain at large discourse. While here they do remain.
So what did you hear? In the first line, "Gentles, perchance you wonder at this show," the orchestra plays along with the tune. It's bouncy and simple, but then it suddenly stops. When Bottom says, "But wonder on," there's no orchestra. Either Bottom is ad-libbing some words, or the orchestra is lost. The same thing happens again with the introduction of Pyramus and Thisbe. Pyramus gets music, Thisbe doesn't. This is exactly what you would expect from Shakespeare's amateur thespians. Somebody's messed up. But the joke is Britain's, not Shakespeare's. As soon as we've seen the pattern, Britain changes it. Bottom's introduction of the wall keeps expanding until it's too long to fit. The words "doth present wall" are sticking out there all by themselves. And since he's a ham, Bottom crams in even more syllables with that silly little vocal flourish about the wall being vile. Bottom ends his one page of music with a cadenza, the name for the 18th century ornamental vocal passage that went at the end of a big important aria. Think of Violetta at the end of Act I of La Traviata. In Bottom's mind, his little page of music is no less important. Since cadenzas were originally improvised, they tended either to stay with one or two syllables of text or to repeat words that had already been heard. The repetition could get silly. Certainly, there's no other way to describe Bottom repeating the word "remain" 12 times in a row. The first time you heard Bottom's prologue, you knew he was being simultaneously amateurish and pompous. The genius of Midsummer Night's Dream is that this is conveyed in the music. Using half the text of the original play, the opera captures most, if not all, of the pathos and humor of the Shakespeare original. The excerpts you are hearing today are from an EMI Classics recording, featuring James Bowman as Oberon, Lillian Watson as Titania, John Graham Hall as Lysander, Henry Herford as Demetrius, Della Jones as Hermia, Jill Gomez as Helena, and Donald Maxwell as Bottom. Richard Hickox conducts the City of London Symphonia, and special thanks to EMI for allowing us to use these recordings. Not all of Britain's musical tricks are audible in a 70-second excerpt. The larger musical structures are also critical. Benjamin Britten was a pacifist, at a time when that was not just unpopular, it was downright dangerous. Today we think of the composer from his later pictures. But in 1939, when Germany invaded Poland and Britain responded by declaring war, Britain was only slightly above prime military age. He was 25 years old. He was also in America, having left England in 1939 with his partner, the tenor Peter Pears, and their friend, the poet W.H. Auden. They returned to England in 1942, after the Blitz, and applied to the government for exemption from military service as conscientious objectors. This was a position that would become more and more unpopular as World War II progressed. With the London musical establishment and audiences alike skeptical of the young composer's politics, his sexuality, and his music, Britten withdrew more and more from London society. In 1949, he and Pears moved to Suffolk, where in the next year they founded their own summer music festival, the Aldeburgh Festival. It was at the festival that many of Britten's subsequent works would be premiered, including Midsummer Night's Dream. Aldeburgh, unlike London, not only accepted Britten, but was actually proud of him. The festival became a going concern, fed both by local interest and by the participation of Britten and Pears's friends from the international musical world. Audiences continued to grow, and by the late 1950s, it was apparent that Jubilee Hall needed to be refurbished. It was for the 1960 reopening of that hall that Britten decided to compose a new opera. Making that decision in August 1959 imposed a short timetable on the composer. Rossini may have composed Barber of Seville in 2 weeks, but modern opera was less tolerant of formulaic orchestrations and completely intolerant of composers recycling previously published music. The new opera would need to take shape quickly, and the most obvious way to save time was to work with an existing libretto. Britten had already considered setting Shakespeare's words, and here was the opportunity to do it. Pears and the composer would adapt the play, preserving Shakespeare's exact text. This was no small commitment. Gounod, Verdi, Wagner, and any number of other composers had set Shakespearean plays to music over the years. But they had the advantage that their audiences were reading Shakespeare in translation. If an extra scene showed up in Gounod's Romeo and Juliet, who was to know? More important was the language difference. We know every word of the line, O Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? But we don't talk that way. Half Britain's audiences would expect him to modernize, but the other half would be equally scandalized if the line following that one became, just tell your father to blow it out his ear. In the end, the opera's libretto contains only half a line not written by Shakespeare. But a good deal written by Shakespeare did not make it into the opera. It couldn't. It takes longer to sing a sentence than to speak it. And there are not many successful six-hour comic operas. In the original play, Lysander says to Hermia, "And to that place the sharp Athenian law cannot pursue us." Since peers in Britain cut the explanation of why the lovers needed to flee Athens, the line became, "And to that place the sharp Athenian law compelling thee to marry with Demetrius cannot pursue us." Rather economical, considering that those six words allowed the composer to cut almost all of Shakespeare's first act. How was the composer to preserve Shakespeare's original language while cutting half the words? Thanks to the Wedding March, Mendelssohn's setting of A Midsummer Night's Dream is almost universally recognized. But Mendelssohn was writing incidental music. Britain needed to present a coherent evening of theater. He found his solution in the music.